This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
John Gasvanian holds a doctorate in history from Oxford. He began his career with the Sunday Times and went on to cover British politics for The Nation. He wrote for Newsweek. His new book, Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil, will be published by Harcourt in April. John has an essay in the winter issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review that is just out on newsstands, probably one of the very best yet of this award-winning magazine, the VQR, produced, published here locally at the university. And John has an essay in there called The Curse of Oil. And John Gasvanian joins us on the phone. Hey, John, how you doing?
Hi. Thank you for having me.
A beautiful essay. I mean, it really is powerful, and I've really been looking forward to talking to you about it. And just to remind folks again, we're talking about the Virginia Quarterly Review. The winter issue is out. Editor Ted Genoways will be in next week to talk about it. But we were incredibly fortunate to get author and essayist John Gasvanian on the phone now to talk about this this headlining essay in this issue, The Curse of Oil. For folks, John, who haven't seen this issue yet and haven't had a chance to pick it up, set the scene for us. What are we looking at when we talk about the curse of oil? And, of course, we're talking about African oil.
Sure. Thank you for the kind words, and thanks for having me. What I've written about in the Virginia Quarterly Review is actually an excerpt from my book, as you mentioned, which is a larger look at the issues and the politics of African oil. And you're right, there is a certain amount of scene setting that needs to be done. Obviously, I think a lot of us, myself included, going into this, didn't know a hell of a lot about African oil. I think when we tend to think about oil, we think of the Middle East. If we're particularly informed, we might think about Venezuela, Russia, and possibly Nigeria. But what a lot of people, I think, don't realize is that actually the United States gets about 17% roughly now of its imported oil from Africa, which is about as much as we get from Saudi Arabia. And that figure is expected to climb to about 25% over the next 5 or 6 years. So it's a rapidly developing story, and an important one that I think perhaps we don't always pay a great deal of attention to.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. When we think of oil, we think of the Middle East, and we don't, most people at least, don't immediately think of Africa. Now, your story in the Virginia Quarterly Review, which we should point out is part of a larger book, which will come out this spring, your story takes a look at a specific what's happening on the ground locally among some of these people, what the local politics surrounding this the oil in Africa and multinationals coming into these small villages and drilling and pulling the oil out. What's going on? It's actually pretty devastating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as you said, the essay looks specifically at Nigeria, which some of your listeners will be more familiar with than some of the other African oil producers. Nigeria, just to give a bit of background, I mean, this is a country that has been producing oil now for just about 50 years. It's one of the largest oil producers in the world. It's, depending on how you measure it, it's seventh or eighth largest of the world's oil producers. It is the fifth largest supplier of oil to the United States, which is important to realize, I think, for a lot of your listeners. We get a lot of our oil from Nigeria, and it's a major oil producer. It's a member of OPEC, has been for many years. This is a country that is one of the most important in Africa, even leaving aside the oil. It's 130 million people. It's one of the largest countries in Africa, major regional powerhouse, etc. As I say, oil exploration has been going onshore, on land, in Nigeria since about 1956, when Shell Oil, the British-Dutch multinational, first began drilling in the Niger Delta, which is where all of Nigeria's oil comes from. Over those 50 years, Nigeria has made something like around $400 billion, that's billion with a B, from oil exploration and production activity. But as you say, the people who have been most affected by this, perhaps not surprisingly, have in many ways not only not reaped the benefits from this prodigious oil exploration that's taken place in their backyard, but have actually suffered quite a bit from it. The Niger Delta, where the Niger River flows out into the Gulf of Guinea, is geographically very similar to, say, Louisiana or the Everglades. It's a vast area of mangrove swamp. swamps and very, very low-lying terrain. It's mostly fishing villages. People are extremely poor. They live really in the dark ages. I mean, they live as their ancestors would have done hundreds of years ago. Many, many people don't have electricity or running water. They live in these small hand-built mud huts or cement huts and rely on small-scale self-sustaining fishing, basically, to survive. What you have cheek by jowl with these people are some of the most sophisticated, ultra-modern, state-of-the-art facilities known to man. I mean, you basically have hundreds of miles of pipelines crisscrossing the delta. You have large air-conditioned facilities with state-of-the-art technology surrounded by razor wire, barbed wire, and you know, guys with AK-47s. It's a tense, tense environment, and it has been for most of those 50 years.
John Gasvinian is our guest. He's got a new essay in the winter edition of the Virginia Quarterly Review called The Curse of Oil. John, you traveled to Niger. You were on the ground there. You met with these people. Tell us about bunkering and illegal bunkering, and explain to people what that is and why it's significant, and more importantly, why Americans should know about this.
Basically, oil is being stolen. And this is one of the really remarkable things. Nigeria, as I say, is one of the world's largest oil producers. There's about 2.5 million barrels a day, which is a lot. But about 100 or 200,000 barrels of those every single day just disappear. They never actually make it into the international market. Reason being, many of these people that we've been talking about over the years have found that their frustrations have not been addressed. The scene in the Niger Delta has become progressively more violent over the years. And unfortunately, 5 or 6 years ago, people started to realize that actually they could tap in some of these pipelines, break into some of the manifolds and flow stations, and literally actually steal the crude oil away from these multinational corporations and sell them. Basically, stick them into little jerry cans, into little plastic jerry cans, stick them onto small, you know, hand rowed canoes and speedboats and take them out to barges, which then take them out to oil tankers that are parked offshore, which then take the oil off in very large quantities and sell it to neighboring countries where there are refineries. It's a remarkable business. You have impoverished, illiterate jungle dwellers who have finally figured out that no one's going to really pay much attention to their needs and feel that this is their oil and that it's being stolen from them, and they're going to steal some of it back.
I thought what was interesting in the essay was this distinction between the elites are stealing the crude oil, and the poorer folks are left to steal the natural gas.
Well, it's a little more complicated than that, and it's this stuff is it does get very complex, and I don't want to bore your listeners too much. But initially, it started out with literally what I'm talking about, stealing crude oil. What happened after a while is, I mean, this is the great irony. One of the many ironies of the Niger Delta is that. You know, young gangs of boys started to get into this crude oil theft and smuggling to try to, you know, reclaim what they felt was theirs. It was a political statement initially, and it very quickly it became a parody of itself. And what happened was that it ended up being controlled by organized mafias and over-organized gangs and Nigerian politicians at the highest levels. So the same people for the average resident of the Niger Delta, they felt, here we're getting ripped off again by the same people who have been ripping us off, you know, formally and officially for many years, and we try to, you know, steal the oil and take matters into our own hands, and the same thing happens again. So you're right, illegal bunkering has reached the very highest, unfortunately, echelons of Nigerian society and the political scene.
And what's so significant, John Gasvinian, our guest, is that the money that they're making off of stealing the oil out of these pipelines, which, as you say, just crisscross through the jungles and the villages, and many of the folks in Africa are taking this money and buying AK-47s and funding militias.
That's right. Unfortunately, again, this is not a happy story. A lot of this money that was, as I say, what started out in sort of idealistic fashion, a lot of the money has ended up supporting criminal activity and militant gangs, ethnic militias, many of which have been co-opted by local politicians to help them win elections and so on. There are groups, as you say, quite rightly, of gangs and ethnic militias that support all their activities largely through an illegal bunkering.
I was struck in your story, but I mean, I got to tell you, the courage that it must have taken as a journalist to go into some of these areas. Tell folks, who is Dokubo Asari, is that it? Who is this man? And tell us the story about your going to meet him.
Dokubo Asari is one of the ethnic groups that's been most affected by oil exploration, the Ijaw, IJAW. And Dokubo Asari is an Ijaw leader who, in 2003, when they had elections in Nigeria, he was basically used by one of the governors to help him win his elections. He and his thugs were used to intimidate people into voting for local politicians. This is a guy who got disillusioned, felt that he wasn't getting his just desserts after the elections and so on, and basically said to his boys, okay, the game is on. Come out of the creeks, and we're going to take this fight to the Nigerian government. And he claims to have 2,000 fighters under his command. He, in late 2004, you might remember, some of your listeners might remember when oil first went over $50 a barrel, and it was a kind of a great big story. And it was this guy who did it. He was responsible for that. Basically, there were running battles for a couple of weeks with the Nigerian army in the Delta. I did meet him in early 2005 after some of these battles had come to a close. He's an interesting guy, obviously. This was September, October 2004 when fighting broke out between his militia and the Nigerian state. It very quickly came to an end, in no small part thanks to the pressure from the United States and other Western governments, who basically freaked out at the thought of large amounts of oil being shut in. Which is what tends to happen when there's a lot of conflict in the Delta. And basically strong-armed the Nigerian government into making a deal with this guy. Now, you have to picture this. This is a kid, who's running around with AK-47s in the jungle, declaring war on the Nigerian state. He gets, in most countries, you don't get very far doing that. But he actually got invited up to the presidential palace in Abuja, in the Nigerian capital, for a meeting with the Nigerian president, at which an American official was present to make sure everything went okay. He was given a bunch of money, which ostensibly was described as payment for collected weapons, although they quickly rearmed themselves. He was told to go off and be a good boy and not cause too much trouble. And he was kind of let off and, given a bit of amnesty. I met him shortly thereafter in his very large, very well decked out house in Nigeria. The guy's got two or three Land Cruisers that are very kitted out to the teeth, all the accessories. He's got a palatial home, big screen TVs and leather couches and so on. He met me. We talked for a little bit. He's a fiery character, obviously, as you might expect. He is an intelligent, articulate individual. He insists that his money is his own. He hasn't been bought off by anybody.
John, are there people like him across Africa, these warlords with thousands of young men with AK-47s and these little militias just sort of pocketed throughout Africa that are getting money off of this stolen oil, literally just taking oil out of these pipelines?
Well, I guess this would be a good place to sort of step back and remind your listeners, at the risk of condescension, that Africa is obviously composed of 54 countries and a couple thousand ethnic groups, but the situation is very different in different parts of Africa. Nigeria's situation is quite unusual in that in most of the big oil producers that have been coming online in Africa in the recent years, the oil is actually offshore in deep water. So the drilling takes place often a couple hundred miles offshore in very deep water and doesn't really the locals never even see what's taking place. Money goes straight into government treasuries and so on. Nigeria is the kind of exceptional case where the oil exploration activity really takes place in the face of locals, in their backyards. So to answer your question, this is fairly unique to Nigeria, this kind of situation.
You write in the book about the reaction among the big oil companies doing drilling and getting oil out of this part of Africa. Explain that to people, how there's been sort of a transformation of their feelings and their approach to what's going on there.
Well, yeah. I mean, yes and no. I think Nigeria's got to the point where there's only so much that can really be done. And I think there are genuinely people of goodwill in some of these oil companies who are trying to figure out what they're supposed to do, what their next steps are. This is a situation that's got a long background and a long history. And for many, many years, the oil company simply turned up, found the local village chief, gave him a bunch of money and said, please let us do our job and don't interfere with what we're doing. And that didn't work very well. That tended to cause a lot of conflict among villagers who claimed that X pipeline or Y flow station was actually on their land and not the other villagers' land. That tended to create conflicts between people who were trying to become tribal chiefs because there was a lot of money in it suddenly. They were literally trying to pay kids to stay at home and not hijack oil installations. These days, I think oil companies are looking for a more sophisticated approach, to be a little bit generous to them. But it's tough. It's tough to really see that the problems have become so entrenched now, and there's so much anger and so much frustration, and after so many years of people not seeing any improvement to their lives, and seeing a lot of disruption to their lives, the oil companies are a very natural target. They're there. They are at the coal face, as it were. They are there day in and day out, in a way that the Nigerian state isn't. The Nigerian government has equal responsibility, if not more so, for the problems of the Niger Delta.
When I finished your essay and put the magazine down, I sat back and all I could think was, it looks like it's only going to get a lot worse over there before it gets any better. I mean, it really looks explosive. Not that the explosions haven't happened, literally, but it really, the future there looks pretty bleak.
It's difficult to be optimistic about Nigeria. And I love Nigeria, and I'm an optimist by nature, but it is very difficult to be optimistic about Nigeria. This is a country that was described a couple of years ago by an internal CIA think tank as a country whose complete collapse was a possibility and could bring down the entire West African sub-region with it. The report described Nigeria as a state whose leaders were locked together in a marriage that all hated but none dared leave. It's a country of 200 ethnic groups, many of whom despise one another, where the stakes are very, very high, obviously because of all the oil money, where conflict is constant, corruption is deep and entrenched, and reasons for optimism are few and far between, frankly. And I wish I could be more rosy in my assessment, but unfortunately it is very difficult to see the light at the end of the tunnel in Nigeria. There are elections coming up in April. And things are probably going to get worse, certainly before the elections, as people jockey for power.
John, I got about a minute left, but okay. I just wanted to say, when you're standing in line for gas here in Virginia or Iowa or Idaho, that stuff happening in Niger where this oil comes from, a lot of this oil comes from, it really seems a world away. You don't think about it. Why should we be thinking about it? And you just mentioned the fact that the collapse of this country poses a threat to that whole part of the continent. Why do you want people to be thinking about this? What's the most important for Americans to keep in mind about what's going on right now in Africa vis-a-vis oil, getting our oil out of there or the oil that we use?
I'll tell you a little anecdote, actually, from a different African country that I spent quite a bit of time with, which is Angola, where Chevron actually has some operations in Cabinda. And, a guy, a Roman Catholic priest in his 40s, who for many years has been an activist there, the issues are very different there, and we obviously don't have time to go into them. But he said, a lot of the people here understand that the American employees, the Americans here from Chevron, are not to blame for all their problems. But they're there, and you see the thing is, after a while, people are just starting to hate them. They're starting to really to hate them. And it really kind of made an impression on me. This is, as I say, a Roman Catholic priest, not a man of war, saying to me, the Americans are the ones they're starting to hate. And I think that our experience with oil exploration all across the world, I think we've learned a lot I would hope, in recent years about difficult compromises that are often involved to maintain our way of life. And if we're not aware of what's going on, we may pay the price for it in the future.
The essay is The Curse of Oil. It's in the winter edition of the Virginia Quarterly Review on newsstands now. A beautifully written, fascinating, gripping story of what's going on the ground right now in Niger. And John Gazvinian, the author, our guest. Thank you, John, so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Take care. This interview will be archived in its entirety on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit sevillepodcast.com for more.